Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, she is a freshman congresswoman and Air Force veteran. Representative Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania's 6th District joins us to talk about how she and her fellow veterans are working to make Congress less partisan and more productive. And we'll hear from a Delaware state senator who's had enough of all the springing forward and falling back. Senate President pro tempore David McBride will explain why he's pushing to keep Delaware and its neighboring states on daylight savings time for good. We'd love for you to weigh in with your thoughts about daylight savings time and whether we ought to keep it or keep things the way they are. You can call us at 888-474-9499 when we get to that. Or you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. And on Twitter, you can get to us at @WHYYRadioTimes. But first, it's becoming a hot-button issue in Philadelphia's city council race. Most of the city's 50-plus council candidates say that Philadelphia's tax abatement program needs to be revamped or even eliminated, that it's helping those who don't need it and hurting those who do. WHYY's Ryan Briggs has been writing about this, and he joins us to shed some light on the issue. Ryan, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the abatement program, and how does it work?
So the abatement is essentially a way of reducing or eliminating the property taxes that would be owed otherwise on new or significantly improved construction. So it's essentially a program that was pitched, you know, some 20 years ago, nearly. To try to incentivize construction by lowering the property tax burden on new units of residential housing, commercial properties, I mean, you know, anything that's newly constructed.
So those taxes are then deferred for 10 years.
That's right.
If you either build something new or you make improvements to existing buildings, whether it's residential or commercial.
Yeah, I mean, I think the majority of the abatement tends to go towards just new construction. And that's kind of what a lot of people associate it with. But it is also on, you know, serious, you know, changes in the improved value of a property could also qualify.
So the program's been in effect for a long time, as you mentioned. What's been the return on investment to the city to this point, financially, in terms of jobs? What have we gotten for in exchange for doing that program?
Well, it's a very controversial subject, just like the tax abatement itself is controversial. If you were to look at reports from the, you know, the Building Industry Association, which is sort of like a developers group, you know, they would say that for every, you know, $1 that's abated, the city sees a $2 return on investments if it's through wage tax collections from new residents moving into the city, or, you know, sales tax, or through the jobs that are created by construction that, at least in theory, wouldn't have happened without the abatement, that the city realizes, you know, some kind of a positive return on investment. And other people would say that, you know, you're sort of throwing, you know, money at a problem that doesn't exist, and that you're essentially giving away tax benefits for construction that would happen already, or for construction that is, you know, at a price for people that can afford to, you know, pay whatever, you know, the difference might be, you know, in the tax bill at the end of the day.
So a lot of people who are questioning that are city council candidates, and you've written about that. There's mm-hmm. You said there's more than 50 candidates now, correct?
I believe that's the last count that I saw, but don't quote me on it because there's so many of them.
It's changing all the
yeah.
time. And you said that a lot of them feel that it's time to either rethink or eliminate the tax abatement. Why?
We had reported on there being kind of a survey that was sent around by a progressive group. And I believe at the time that they did the survey, a sizable majority of the declared candidates said that they either supported completely abolishing the 10-year tax abatement or at least seriously, you know, overhauling the abatement. And this kind of matches a conversation that you've seen in city council where a lot of people are saying, you know, maybe it's time to reevaluate this mechanism. This was something that was created in the 1990s when, you know, the city saw very low rates of construction, residential construction, housing construction, And, you know, for developers, they will often say, you know, this is a way of kind of compensating for the city's higher than average costs of construction. And so at that time in the 90s, you know, they said, if you want to have like, you know, any kind of construction, you know, business in Philadelphia, you need to be abating this value. You need to be making it more desirable for people to build here by making the properties that they eventually sell more desirable with a tax abatement. Now people look around and they say, well, there's tons of construction, right? And do you need to be abating properties in Center City, for example, to compensate, you know, for the high cost of construction, you know, or the low, you know, cost of sale, you know, in a per square foot sense, or, you know, whatever it might be. And some people say no, right? Like that we're building, you know, multi-million-dollar condo units. Enough is enough, right?
Yeah. And so a lot of the council candidates are saying that by deferring this tax money, you're really taking money away from the Philadelphia School District that's been in dire straits for a long time financially.
Right.
So talk about the concerns around that.
So, you know, 55%, I believe, of the property tax revenue the city realizes goes to the local school district, the Philadelphia School District. So there are a lot of people who say, you know, there's something like 15,000 properties that receive this abatement. It's, you know, millions of dollars of deferred tax revenue every year. That's a direct A to B, right, in terms of lost revenue or unrealized revenue, I should say, for the school district. And so for a lot of people, they've sort of made this into an issue of saying, here's a way, you know, to get badly needed revenue for the school district by phasing this out, you know, immediately in some instances. And other people saying, maybe we should look at readjusting which areas of the city get this, or, you know, the amount of the abatement. You know, there's a variety of different proposals, as many as there are council candidates right now.
And yet you do have, every year, a certain number of those properties are coming out of that abatement status. So there is revenue that's coming in every year. Who is tracking that and measuring how many properties are coming off, how much more tax revenue is coming to the city, and 55% of that going to the school district? Who's tracking all that?
It would usually be the Department of Revenue, the Office of Property Assessment. There are departments of the city, you know, that focus on tax collection, and they would generally be keeping track of the abated values of these various properties. And at least in theory, you know, when they expired and the properties came back into the tax rolls.
Yeah. So do you have a sense of how much money we're seeing as these properties come off the abatement rolls each year? What does that mean to the school district, and what do they get from that, and to the city for that matter?
I mean, they absolutely realize, you know, the whatever the, you know, full value of those properties would be. I mean, it's kind of hard to put an exact number on it because it changes year to year in terms of, you know, you're talking about essentially how many properties were abated 10 years ago each year, and what was that number, and how many of them come back. And I don't know if the Department of Revenue keeps track of that. I mean, it's certainly the full value of the of all the abated properties is in the millions of dollars a year, you know, many millions. So there is something that is realized by, you know, the phase out process, for sure. I think some people are saying we don't want to wait 10 years, right? If we're building, you know, a condominium now that's going to sell for $500,000, you know, we want to be realizing the tax revenue on that now, not 10 years from now.
And I saw something on the city's own website that said in 10 years, currently abated properties are expected to generate $100 million a year. So, and I'm guessing give or take, but $100 million is what the city's talking about. Why is it so important, though, for the Philadelphia School District, Ryan, to be able to access this money sooner? What is the situation in the Philadelphia School District? We all know that there have been numerous, you know, financial struggles over the years. So, and there's a lot of passion around this and making sure that the school district does get that money. What's the source of all of that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of sources. It's like you're saying, you know, there's been the historic financial problems that the local school district has had. There is the you know, projections of, you know, increasing cost burdens in years to come. There are also, you know, more direct examples of what this all means, in the sense that we have school buildings that still have, you know, lead paint in them. You have a seriously deferred facilities catalog, meaning there's a lot of school buildings that need to be repaired, maybe replaced entirely. And there's kids who go to school in buildings that were built like in the Victorian era still in some cases. I mean, these are old buildings. There's a lot of need there For sure. I think that the argument here is just that, you know, if you, it, the way that these numbers pan out, if I'm a developer, if I'm a city administrator, is we're probably going to realize more by incentivizing all this new development. In the long run, we're going to see more money. I think other people look at it and they say, this is just unfair. It's unequal, right? You're giving benefits to people who can afford to buy new housing, who are the people that are the most able to pay their tax bills.
So how do you think all of this will impact the city council races? Because as you have written, a majority of candidates are saying that minimally that we need to rethink this, if not eliminate it. How do you think it's going to play out?
I think that the political dynamics around the tax abatement are such that it is appealing to both private developers and the building trades, the unions that work a lot of these jobs. And that makes it, that has made it a very difficult battle for people who want to abolish the tax abatement, because those two groups tend to be the biggest political contributors. They tend to have a lot more political power than other sectors, say the legal sector or something, you know, like that. And when you have both of these very powerful interest groups kind of behind this policy, I think that's part of the reason that you've seen it take so long for there to be kind of a popular movement to eliminate, to even reduce the tax abatement. I mean, for all the talk about it, and this isn't the first time that it's come up, right? There was an effort, I think, 10 years ago to do away with it. There's been talk about it, you know, in years, pretty much every year since. You see a situation where I think it's very difficult to overcome that, even though it should be an easy sell to people, right? You walk down the street and you say, hey, do you pay property taxes? Well, most people pay property taxes, right? But there's 15,000, you know, owners in the city that own property and don't pay. And a lot of people, I think that's very visceral to them. They say, why are these people, you know, getting exempted from this and I'm not? But the dynamic has been very hard to overcome to date.
Yeah. Well, how about very quickly in our last, you know, few seconds here, just public sentiment. There have been protests. Do you think that public sentiment is such that this could make a difference for some candidates in the upcoming race?
I think that it sort of speaks for itself in terms of the popularity of abolishing or seriously, you know, reimagining the tax abatement, in the sense that so many candidates have run on this. We profiled a candidate, you know, who just said, I'm not taking a single dollar from real estate interests through my campaign because I don't want to have any sort of connection to that. But, you know, I think what really matters are the people, you know, who wind up winning these races, who wind up, you know, being in city council. And honestly, there's not that many seats that are up this year. I mean, there's a good number, but it's not, you know, it's not like, you know, half of council or the majority of council right are up for this. And you need ultimately to get enough votes to pass this and to have maybe a veto-proof majority. If the mayor were to say, I'm going to veto efforts to abolish the tax abatement, you know, the Kenney administration, Mayor Jim Kenney, has taken, I think, a more moderate line on a lot of this stuff. I don't think I've heard him call for abolition of it, right? So that's what really matters, is I think, you know, what are the dynamics when you get into office? And what you see is that it's still popular among unions and the developers.
There'll be a lot for you to write about in the coming weeks and months. Ryan Briggs, thank you so much for being with us. Hey, we want to mention that there is a Philadelphia City Council candidate convention here at WHYY this evening from 5:30 to 8. More than 30 candidates will be here at our studios. You can come and meet them and see what they think for yourself. Radio Times Regional Roundup will be right back. Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. In about 20 minutes, we will be talking with a Delaware state legislator who has had enough of this back and forth with daylight savings time, Eastern Standard Time. He is introducing legislation that would put Delaware and surrounding states on daylight savings time permanently. We'd love to hear your thoughts about that. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can reach us on Twitter at WHYY Radio Times. We'd love to hear your thoughts when we get to that in about 20 minutes. In the meantime, however, November's midterm elections saw the greatest number of military veterans elected to Congress in 10 years. Among them is Air Force veteran Chrissy Houlihan, who represents Pennsylvania's 6th District. Representative Houlihan is one of the leaders of a newly formed Veterans Caucus in Congress designed to make it less partisan and more productive. And she joins us now to talk about just how they plan to get that done. Representative Houlihan, welcome to Radio Times. All right. Do we have Representative Houlihan on the line? We are working on...
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, there she is. There she is. I can hear you now. Yes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So you represent Pennsylvania's 6th District, which has new boundaries now since the Pennsylvania Supreme Court redrew the map last year. Before we get into the caucus, tell us about the 6th District. What are the boundaries now?
Sure. The 6th Congressional District is much more compact and contiguous and constitutional. It is all of Chester County, and it is the lower part of Berks County, which includes the city of Reading. And importantly, in its new redrawing, it is still 40% Democrat, 40% Republican, and 20% Independent. So we're a very purple place.
So you are part of the newly formed Four Country Caucus in Congress, made up of military veterans from both sides of the aisle. Why does that caucus exist?
We created that caucus out of, I think, a real need that we heard on the campaign trail throughout the last cycle, that we really needed to find a way to get together and to find common ground on the things that we can all agree on. And veterans historically have been known for their ability to, you know, see the mission and to set party politics aside and to get things done as a team. And so we thought by creating this caucus of veterans across the aisle with all kinds of ideology that we had the opportunity to be able to legislate on things that we could agree on.
So what are some of those things, for example?
So what we're looking to do is what we kind of call base hits and home runs. And the base hits may be things as simple as those things that we can get kind of co-sponsorship and bipartisanship on, either legislation or on letters. A most recent letter that I put forward that was bipartisanly supported had to do with making sure that women, as they exit the military, have better access to education and training about what their VA benefits are. And so that was something that we could all agree was necessary as the number of women in the military increases and the number of, therefore, women who are exiting or separating from the military also increases. And the home runs that we talk about are things like national service. We, as a collective, as a caucus, really believe in the importance of national service, and that just doesn't have to do with military service, but also maybe Teach for America, City Year, Peace Corps, any of those organizations that bring us together as a country, that allow us to see each other in different places and hopefully allow us to be a more unified nation. Those are important efforts for all of us to elevate and support.
Yeah, I want to drill down on a couple of the things that you said, and one of them was about women in the military and accessing benefits. Why is that important? Are you finding that women have not typically been pursuing those benefits, and why does that matter?
Yes, that is in fact the case. I think largely, I obviously served active duty a while ago, and it actually never occurred to me to investigate what the VA could do for me. And I think that's largely because women veterans have not necessarily seen the VA as being an organization that serves women, because we are a lower part of the population of active duty military and separated veterans as well. And so this is just a recognition of that fact, that women are less likely to access the VA. And this training program, this pilot training program that we are trying to elevate, actually just is 4 hours of education that allows women who are leaving the military to understand what benefits are available to them. And what we've seen as a result of this pilot program is that they are half as likely to commit suicide and much more likely to access the VA if they've just had this simple training. And women veterans are much more likely to commit suicide than their civilian counterparts. And so this is a really important initiative.
Well, since you mentioned that, I did want to ask you about something I read that was really striking, that said that just this month, three veterans committed suicide on VA properties around the country. And according to the latest data from the VA, 20 veterans die by suicide every day. And of those, 14 are not receiving VA health care. And I'm wondering what is being done to address that. It sounds like an epidemic among veterans.
It is, and I think that it starts with education and allowing people to understand that where their VA is, how they access it, what sorts of help is available to them, not just with the VA itself, but also from the economy. One of the things that we talked about is that there's always signs up, you know, kind of all over the VA. If you need help, this is where you can call. We even had some outreach training that people were participating in recently that I went to that was just about access to food. And during that training, there was actually a conversation about mental health and also about suicide prevention and suicide training. We need to be very vigilant about this. It is a chronic epidemic, and it is incredibly worrisome.
Yeah. You also mentioned national service just a moment ago, and you mentioned specifically Teach for America. And if I read it right, you have some experience with Teach for America, and you even taught in Philadelphia at Simon Gratz. Is that correct?
I did. I participated in the Corps in 2011, so I was one of those few people who joined the Teach for America organization in her mid-40s rather than her early 20s. And I did have the amazing experience of teaching chemistry in North Philadelphia at Simon Gratz. And that experience actually led me to understand a really big issue that we have in our communities, which is a lot of our kids aren't reading at grade level. And if they're not reading at grade level, then they are not able to sort of be part of the successful economy that we've created for them. And so as a consequence, early childhood literacy became something that I focused on up and until running for Congress. And it is now actually something that the With Honor Caucus is also focusing on, because many of us are making sure that our military is ready. And readiness has to do with making sure that people who would like to enter the military have the skills that they need to do that. And if they don't have basic literacy skills, then they cannot participate in our military and are not, our military is therefore not ready for action.
Yeah. We noted that in the most recent midterm elections that we saw more military veterans elected than there have been in the last 10 years. How do you account for that? Why do you think we've seen such an increase in the number of veterans this time around?
And also the number of women veterans has doubled in the last cycle as well. So that's also an interesting statistic to note. I think that the number of veterans in the military, in the Congress hasn't increased significantly. It has increased slightly. But I do think that there definitely was an answer to a call of action of sorts in the 2016 election, where a lot of veterans felt as though they had the right skills to be able to heal this nation. Right now, I think one of the biggest issues that I saw on the campaign trail was the importance of civility. And the With Honor Caucus, we take an oath of civility to make sure that we are being decent to one another. And I think a lot of veterans felt like that they not only had the skills to be able to serve and find pragmatic solutions, but also would be able to bring back that sense of decency and civility to the nation.
You're listening to WHYY-FM. This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking with Representative Chrissy Houlihan from Pennsylvania's 6th District, and we are talking about the newly formed caucus, the four-country caucus in Congress that is designed to help Congress run more smoothly. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, on Twitter, @WHYY Radio Times, or you can always call 888-477-9499. And speaking of calls, Representative Houlihan, we do have a question here from Ed who says, will the Veterans Caucus address the backlog of VA appeals?
So I think what's really exciting about the Veterans Caucus or the With Honors Caucus is that we all sit on various different committees within the House. And so, for instance, I sit on the Armed Services and the Foreign Affairs Committee, but other members of the Four Country Caucus do sit on that Veterans Affairs Committee. And so absolutely, those will be some of the things that we take a look at. And with an increasing number of unified veterans in Congress, I think that we are definitely being heard more loudly than we have historically. And we have a little bit more credibility when we talk into these issues, I think, in our seats in Congress, having had the experience of serving.
You mentioned just a moment ago about the oath of civility that you take in the caucus, and it's one thing to have an oath of civility among yourselves, but anybody who has been watching Congress for any length of time is not unfamiliar with the bickering, the gridlock, the polarization. How will the caucus try to address that on a macro level with Congress to try to make things more civil, more bipartisan in a general sense?
So I think the biggest way that we can do that is by leading by example, even by declaring that we are a unified caucus with incredibly diverse ideological differences within this four-country caucus, and by saying that we are willing to put partisanship and partisan bickering aside to try to get things done for the people, I think is a really good start in Congress. I think that we are starting to see not just this new caucus, but there's about 80 of us who are new in Congress in general this cycle. And we all have come in here with a set of fresh eyes and fresh legs. And I think we really all did run on this idea that our government is broken and that it's very, very divisive and divided, and we need to bring it together. So it's not just the four country folks that are doing this, but it's also all of the new people on both sides of the aisle as well.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the VA Mission Act that was passed last summer that will allow, if I'm understanding it right, large numbers of eligible veterans to seek medical care outside of the federal system. We've been hearing about it more recently because there's been something of a partisan beef going on between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the Democratic side, and then, of course, Dan Crenshaw on the Republican side, about whether the VA will wind up being privatized and whether that's good or not so good for veterans. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that and how the caucus is thinking about that issue.
I can only speak for myself. We haven't had conversations in the caucus yet about this issue, but what I can say is that a strong VA system is essential. We have an amazing VA site here in my community, the Coatesville VA, that I've now visited several times. I've had the opportunity to talk to veterans in my community fairly extensively over the short 100-and-something days that I've been in Congress, and they are very, very satisfied for the most part with the care that they're getting here at the VA. I know that they do have access to other opportunities that are in the sort of civilian economy largely, but I think a healthy VA is essential for our veterans to have, and I think we have it here in Coatesville.
Is there a world in which it does make sense to have some additional choices for veterans? Maybe more convenient care, better access to care, just sort of expanding the range of options by adding some non-federal options for veterans?
Certainly, I think that that's the case. My brother lives in very, very rural Iowa. He is a veteran as well. He is an Army veteran, and his access to a VA is somewhat impeded by the place that he lives. And so there certainly are exceptions to make sure that every veteran has access to quality care. But largely, these very, very well, especially in the case of Coatesville, well-operated and well-run VAs are an important part of the solution.
Yeah. So as you are getting together with the rest of the caucus and you're thinking through some of the issues that you talked about, what's the priority list? What are you looking to tackle first? What do you think is most important to get done? And from there, how does your priority list look?
So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, our strategy is base hits and then home runs. You know, our strategy is first to sort of get to know one another and to develop a sense of trust amongst each other, you know, bring each other ideas on legislation that may already exist or letters of support that are in the process of making their way through the system, and having the opportunity to create relationships based on those, small wins. And then the idea would be, as we get a little bit more seasoned and as hopefully we even bring more people on board, that we work for larger legislative, you know, hits. And I think that that's our strategy, is to get to know each other. And we've had, not only do we have, you know, the civility clause of sorts, but we also are committed to meet with each other regularly, which is also something that frankly doesn't happen in Congress very regularly. It's actually pretty remarkable how little across the aisle camaraderie is allowed to exist with the very crazy schedules that we have. And by carving out very specific time for us to get together, I think that that will create a real sense of trust and the ability to get things done.
Do you see yourselves wading into the more hot button issues eventually, healthcare, immigration, those kinds of things?
So I do believe on something like immigration that there is an appetite for bipartisan, you know, collaboration, not necessarily with this caucus in particular, but with the caucus at whole. We have, historically in Congress, have had the opportunity a few times to pass comprehensive and bipartisan immigration reform. And I hope that there's an appetite for that, not just with the four-country caucus, but with the Congress at large. But right now, I think what we're looking at is to, you know, create those lines of friendship and to be able to move forward on things that we definitely can agree on.
Yeah. Representative, what about you personally? What are your major goals for the time that you are in Congress? What's kind of on your priority list to address and to really try to make a difference in?
Sure. And as I mentioned, my community is one of those purple places. We are, you know, equal parts Republican, Democrat, and a lot of independent, you know, in between. And so the issues of our community, I think, are the issues, frankly, of the country at large. We really need to find a way to have better access to more affordable and quality health care. And that's a very, very important issue for everybody in my community. We really need to make sure that we have jobs that treat one another with dignity, you know, equal wage for equal work. We also need to make sure that we have access to terrific education that just prepares us for these jobs of today and then, of course, the jobs of tomorrow. And that runs the gamut everywhere from early childhood education to higher education, but also to vocational and technical training as well. Very rapidly evolving economy with lots of different moving parts, and making sure that our folks are prepared for that rapidly developing future of work is important. And so those basic human needs are the things that we talk about in our community all the time. And then, of course, issues like gun safety and gun violence is a real signature issue of our community. And then finally, the safety and well-being of the planet.
What do you think will be the biggest challenge? You've mentioned a number of really big ones, but what do you think will be the caucus's biggest challenge as it forms and tries to make Congress a more functional, productive place?
It's really easy to get caught up in the day-to-day of Congress and not lift your head up and see the people who are there, who are frankly all there for various reasons, but really there to serve. And I think the biggest challenge will be not to lose focus on why we created for country, to make sure that we stay, we are together as a team with the mission that we created, that we are reaching out and across the aisle to other people who may not be veterans particularly, but also really would like to see a restoration of dignity and civility in the Congress and a restoration of a government that works for people. So I think making sure we keep our focus will be our bigger challenge.
So in our last 30 seconds or so, Representative, I want to ask you this question. Everybody has been talking about the release of the redacted Mueller report that came out last week. It's been made public. I'm curious to know your thoughts about what you think is going to happen next, and perhaps how the caucus might advise congressional colleagues about what to do. And we've only got about 30 seconds. So your thoughts.
Sure. So in addition to being a veteran and a former educator, I'm also an engineer. And so I tend to be very deliberative about things. And so what is clear right now is that a foreign government actively sought to influence our country's election. And our next steps, I think, are to ask for Mr. Mueller to come and speak in front of us and to move deliberatively to understand what happened in our government and what happened overseas as well. So I'm looking forward to the next steps.
Representative Chrissy Houlihan, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you.
We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. It is a springtime rite of passage. On the second Sunday in March, well, really Saturday night for most of us, we all push our clocks ahead an hour so the days will stay lighter longer until November, of course, when we push them back again. If one Delaware state legislator has his way, though, that could all change. Senate President Pro Tempore David McBride has introduced legislation that would effectively make daylight savings time permanent in the first state as well as surrounding states. Senator McBride joins us to explain why he thinks it's, well, time to make a change. Senator, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, good morning.
So why
I like
the
intro.
Well, thank you. And why do you want to make daylight savings time permanent?
Well, I'm calling it lock the clock and, you know, we want to spring forward, but we don't want to fall back. It's an interesting topic. I had received from constituents inquiries as to why do we spring forward and fall back. And I misunderstood, perhaps, why we did that. I always thought it had to do with the agricultural community and things like that. But to the best of my knowledge and my research indicates, the reason we do it is because we've always done it. And I there's a lot of reasons, really, why I think we could benefit from just locking the clock, if you will. There are studies that show that it influences on the risk of heart attack. Sleep deprivation has to do with automobile accidents. And these are all studies that have been put forward. Increased physical activity. I have parents, since I had made the legislation public, who have called me about what a great idea it was because their children would be able to participate in more sports in the evening after school kind of thing. So yeah. A lot of different reasons why. Basically, that's the answer to that.
And it's also good for retail, they say, because people are more inclined to stop and shop on their way home from work if it's lighter longer. And I think I read one study or one summary that said for the golf industry, even going back to the 80s, there was hundreds of millions of dollars in increased sales after daylight savings time. So good for retail as well, I suspect. Let me just invite I'm sorry.
To truncate my answer. You know, some people say I'll reduce street crime. In addition to increased productivity on job injuries, that kind of thing. So a lot of good reasoning. Energy savings. Now, there have been studies that show that perhaps it isn't an energy savings, so I don't know. That's probably still up in the air to be debated.
Yeah. Well, let me invite our listeners to weigh in on this as well. I'm sure that they've got some thoughts around it. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or Twitter at WHYY Radio Times. So what you're really suggesting then, Senator, is that Delaware operate in the Atlantic time zone, which is sort of one zone east, if you will, from Eastern Standard Time. But Delaware wouldn't be able to do this in a vacuum, right? I would think it would create confusion for sort of one state to take itself out of the mix. So what happens with the neighboring states?
Well, part of the legislation indicates that only if Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey were to do similar legislation with the governor, then be required to petition the United States Secretary of Transportation, who has the authority, by the way, to move us to the Atlantic time zone, which would, in essence, put us an hour forward. I might add, you know, there's presently 15 to 20 states that are discussing the same issue. On the eastern seaboard, a lot of states. And even out west, I think Oregon's doing something, or at least looking at legislation.
So do you think that there's momentum then for that kind of a change, a federally approved change at this point, or are we still a ways from that?
I think we're in the build the momentum stage. You know, you put things out there. It's an idea. Some of my colleagues have offered to sponsor the bill with me. They're quite excited about it. Are enough colleagues excited? I'm not sure yet, so I'm still beating the bushes, if you will, to gain support for the issue.
Yeah, and certainly would have to get the buy-in of the surrounding states to make it work, because I could see that there would be a lot of confusion
even
in terms of doing business. And yeah, a lot of
even after we pass our legislation, we'd have to have, we're a very small state, 32 miles across at our widest place, so you can get to Maryland very quickly from any place in Delaware, and New Jersey the same across the bridge. And so obviously we'd have to all be in tune with the same time, you know.
Is that something you're working on? Are you having conversations with your counterparts in other states to get their buy-in around this?
I am, Connecticut, of course, they're not, adjacent to where they're looking at it. But I, in meetings that I have, I do talk to my colleagues about it, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah. I want to share with you what some of our listeners are saying. Beverly said in an email, "I'm from Delaware and would love to have permanent daylight savings time. However, the switch needs to include at least the 18 states in the Eastern time zone." So Beverly saying what you said, that maybe there needs to be a sort of a mass change here. And Cliff says in an email, "I like this idea. It would help ease seasonal depression, lighter longer."
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's studies that show that. I might add, by the way, the President Trump, in March, I believe, said that he believed that the United States ought to be on daylight saving time. The whole United States, continental United States.
Yeah.
Presently, as you know, there's only two states, Hawaii and Arizona, that don't observe the daylight saving time switch.
And then there's a Pennsylvania state legislator, Senator, who is proposing just the opposite of your legislation, and that is to make Eastern Standard Time permanent.
Interesting.
and so I guess that sort of raises the question, since staying on daylight savings time permanently would require federal approval. Did you say it was the Transportation Department who makes that decision? Does it
well,
maybe...
Well, if to go to the Atlantic Standard Time, the common, you know, the United States Secretary of Transportation would have that responsibility. It's my understanding to do away with daylight saving time, it would take an act of Congress. That's my understanding.
So,
I may be wrong.
Yeah, and I guess it sort of begs the question when I think about this legislation that's being proposed in Pennsylvania about just sticking with Eastern Standard and leaving things alone. Why not consider that? That at least would not require the federal approval steps that you would have to go through to stay on daylight savings time.
Well, I mean, you have the same situation, not to, you know, put a kibosh on it, but... you know, you need the surrounding states. It's like one of your listeners said that obviously it would be much better if you had all 18 eastern seaboard states, you know, on the same length, if you would, you know.
And I guess there is the other issue that some folks have brought up is the whole idea of commuting in the dark. And that's one of the things that we notice when we make that change to daylight savings time, that the mornings are darker for sure. And people are commuting in the dark. There are studies that show that there are more pedestrian involved accidents after daylight savings time. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's one of the things that has been mentioned. And I you know, if you want to put a list together, the pros and cons, one of the concerns that has been raised to me, and I think are legitimate, that the children would have to get a school bus during the dark. Does that happen now? I don't, you know, what time school starts for some people, but obviously that is an issue. It's been my experience, if I might ask. Any legislation always has pros and cons.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, let's go to the phones to Alex from Reading. Alex has a question for you. Welcome to Radio Times, Alex.
Thank you. This question is for the senator. I wanted to know what has been the most common argument against your colleagues who oppose legislation you're trying to introduce.
Very good question. But I think not an argument against it, but this isn't perhaps the most pressing issue that the state of Delaware is dealing with in the legislature. We have other issues that I would concede are much more prioritized, if you will, than in this being budget issues and money issues and some other things. But so I think that's the main thing. You know, like, how much time do you want to spend on something like this when we have other serious issues to deal with?
Yeah. Senator, you mentioned early in our conversation that it was your understanding that this was to benefit the agricultural community when it first started, and you found out that, no, that was not the answer after all. Why did we start implementing daylight savings
time? My understanding, that's a very good question. You know, I'm trying to be brief because you should be asking the questions, and I'm giving you that opportunity, obviously. It's a very interesting and a good question. My understanding is it all started in the First World War when Germany became they started to observe daylight saving time, and so then Britain changed because, you know, they were in war, you know, that was going on, and so the United States followed suit. And then after the war was over, Congress then put us back to it became a local option for some states. And then, if I can go forward, in the Second World War, the same thing happened again, and President Roosevelt established the year-round daylight saving time, called the war. They called it at that time the war time. And then after the war was over, they went back to the, you know. And there's a whole history since then. In 73, and I'm looking at my notes now, Congress enacted the Emergency Daylight Saving Time Energy Conservation Act, in 1973 when there was a, quote, energy crisis, unquote, and then the following year they did away with it. So obviously Congress, you know, they saw fit, they could do that tomorrow kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, and there certainly has been back and forth over the years with it. You mentioned energy savings, and I want to read you something that I found on PBS.org over the weekend. It said, the promised energy savings from going to daylight savings time, and that was the presenting rationale for the policy, have never materialized. It said that, in fact, the best studies we have from the U.S. and abroad prove that Americans use more domestic electricity when they practice daylight saving. Moreover, when we turn off the TV and go to the park or the mall in the evening sunlight, Americans don't walk. We get in our cars and drive, and that daylight savings actually increases gasoline consumption. And so I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that, that while there was some rationale for energy saving, but maybe not so much.
It's a very good point you bring up. The research data that I have done indicates that it could go both ways. There are studies that show that there's modest benefits in the area of energy conservation, but I have also seen, and admittedly, that there are studies that show that, in fact, as you state, there could be some energy deficiencies, if you will, with it. So that one's kind of mushy. You know, like, depending where you want to be, you can – you know, you could be against it or for it, depending on energy.
Yeah. So, well, right. And it all sort of depends on your personal preference. You can make the arguments, I suppose, either way. I want to share with you what PJ said via email. PJ says, for decades, Indiana allowed counties to opt in and out of daylight saving time. The state was a patchwork quilt of time zones every summer, and nothing bad happened. You just had to remember which time zone your supermarket was in, which is all important, of course. So is there...
I can imagine. No, you know, and look, you know, politics, as Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. In other words, you know, it's whatever the governing body, a particular governance body, wants to decide, and, you know, you go from there. My guess is some of that probably had to do with the agricultural community in the state. Yeah, I haven't heard from our agricultural community. We have a very large agricultural component in Delaware in our economy, and I have not heard from them.
Yeah,
but like I said, it's early. You know, you put the process works, and I'm sure you're familiar. You introduce legislation, people start talking about it. You're talking about it. I'm talking about it. Others are talking about it. And that's how good legislation develops. If in the end people determine it's a bad idea, I go on to something else. You know what I mean?
You mentioned early in the conversation about the health benefits, and you said that when we make these time changes, you talked about heart attacks specifically, and certainly any of us who have gone through, you know, daylight savings time back to Eastern Standard Time, it can take us a day or two to get ourselves right again. Why is it, you know, based on the research that you've done, why is it that a one-hour time change either way can wreak so much havoc on our bodies and minds?
That's a very, very good question. But in fact, studies have shown that, you know, that heart attacks significantly increase during the 3 weekdays following the spring transition. Now, why that is, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, but I do know that studies have shown that, in fact, it adversely affects cardiac issues.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly why. Perhaps you need a doctor to call in for that one.
Yeah, 1 hour can make a big difference, though, one way or the other. So, Senator, how optimistic are you that your proposed legislation will pass, and what do you think the timeline is looking like for this?
Oh, I can some of that I can answer. You know, as the president pro tem, one of my jobs is to assign legislation. And this particular legislation, I attempt to put all legislation in the proper committees. Coincidentally, perhaps, this legislation correctly was assigned to my committee by me, you know, the executive committee. So we will be having a hearing on the bill in May. By constitution, Delaware's General Assembly goes until June the 30th. So there's ample time for the Senate to consider it, get over to the House. Now, as to where we would be on the votes, Obviously, I'm hopeful that I would have a majority when it's
brought. Senator, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop you right there because we've got to wrap up. But we will be watching. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, and we'll be watching to see how it all works out.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
You as well. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, and our engineer today is Al Banks. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Up next, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. Thanks so much for listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup.